So thanks, Greg, for the introduction and the perspective on this special session. So what I'd like to do today is set the stage, the broad ecological stage, for the series of specialized talks that come later on urban soils and urban soil quality. So first, what I want to do is provide an ecologist's perspective on the social and ecological complexity of urban grasslands and residential landscapes. So that's the first goal that I have, is just take a look at these integrated social and ecological systems. And I want to say that, in fact, looking at them together really advances our understanding of some of these emergent properties that come from these landscapes. The second thing I want to do is share some new research on the rise of these environmentally friendly landscapes as cities turn from being a sanitary city to more towards a sustainable city. So first, I want to comment on Greg's synopsis in his abstract about urban grasslands as complex systems. So let's be clear. You know, I get this comment all the time from other ecologists: is why are you studying urban landscapes? And I'm sure, you know, this is an urban soil symposium, so I know you know the answer to that. But they're created by and for us, and so the drivers of land cover change and the outcomes, the social ecological outcomes, should be really obvious to us, right? Well, what's been interesting to us ecologists are the many surprises about these landscapes that really you can only take a look at when you take a look at the system as a whole. So my first point is that really understanding the urban landscapes as coupled social ecological systems has been really quite illuminating to us. So, for example, you know, there's been an explosion, as you guys know, there's a number of publications in the field of urban ecology over time. There's been an explosion of people looking at these as coupled systems, not just from the natural science perspective or from the social science perspective, from an interdisciplinary perspective. And, you know, the things that we can see from these landscapes aren't on the minds of every homeowner as she or he makes decisions on her or his landscape, or on the minds of any particular municipality as they all make decisions for their particular constituents. Or it's not even on the minds of us as scientists in terms of studying one system in one place. So over the last 10 years, we've seen this real explosion of this interdisciplinary social ecological work, and that's really framed the kind of work that I do as a soil scientist and now as a social ecological scientist. So, for example, you're all familiar with this classic human effects on the environment. This is the urban heat island. This is a map from Phoenix from some early work by Bob Balling and Tony Brazel. Here's summer nighttime temperatures in Phoenix. I mean, we know it's all really, really hot there. This is 90 degrees C at nighttime in the center of Phoenix here. And we can see that Phoenix is experiencing the urban heat island like many other cities across the nation and across the world. So this is, again, the classic human and human effect on the environment. But by pairing with social science teams, we can actually understand that, in fact, this back arrow hasn't been well studied, that the environment, in turn, changes how people behave. So, for example, as the urban heat island gets warmer, people start to use more water. And for a desert city, the sustainability issues and implications are quite large. But of course, this is a coupled system. And so as people use more water, in fact, the temperatures of their neighborhoods drop. And this is linked to the type of person you are. So social scientists always take a look at what I think about, and they think people aren't in one box. You know, people are different. So if you're wealthy, you're going to have more pools and lawns, which is going to turn cool your landscape. So my first point about urban landscapes from an ecologist's point of view, using these really simple illustrations, is that these are the types of patterns we wouldn't have been able to see as soil scientists looking at one system or one particular soil at a very reductionist perspective. And again, as a soils person by training, this has been really illuminating to me. And it's these internal feedbacks that keep the system and maintain it in its place. And so if we're aiming to change the system, I would argue that we need to take a look at some of these internal positive feedback drivers before we try to implement some sort of change. So my second point, then, is to study the ecology of cities rather than just the ecology in cities. As complex systems, we need to broaden our view to multiple different places and then drop down into our disciplinary perspectives to get some hypotheses about how this type of ecosystem changes from all, or is different or the same from other ecosystems that we know. As ecosystem scientists, we know that there are certain drivers that create ecosystem properties, like the state factors. So, for example, I've got a project now with ecologists across the country. I see one of them here, Peter Grafman, sitting here. Hi, Peter. In the audience, where we're asking the question, does the ecology of these urban landscapes depend on place? And we'd like to put this up. You know, which one of these is Boston? Which one of these is Phoenix?
They don't have very many swimming pools.
Yeah, there it is, right? So when you take a look at the swimming pools over here, this one's Phoenix. But, you know, you wouldn't expect this from the Sonoran Desert, right? This is the Sonoran Desert on the right, and this is the northern temperate forest on the left. So what we're asking in this really super fun project is, are cities ecologically homogeneous ecosystems that function the same regardless of the geography? The idea is that these state factors are the same in all these cities, and so they must function similarly. So we've got social scientists and natural scientist team in all these different cities. What I want to point out is, from an ecologist's point of view, you know, we've got this incredible landscape gradient here from dry, this is evapotranspiration on the left, and you've got, it's, you know, from dry to wet. We have an idea that the climatic background is really different, yet we have these really ecologically similar landscapes turning up. And so I just want to show you an illustration of just a handful of these really exciting results that have come out, again, both social and ecological, that really emphasize that, in fact, despite that these cities are in different places geographically, they function similarly. Here's fertilizer use by Boston, Baltimore, Miami. Here are the cities here. And what's striking to me in this, this is just presence or absence, or like whether they use fertilizers or not, is that overall, regardless if you're in the dry coastal sage scrub around here or in the Sonoran Desert or down in Miami, people generally use between about 40 to 60, 80% of the people use fertilizers. And it's relatively similar, and it really depends whether you're urban, suburban, or rural. I can't see that on the bottom, but essentially people in rural or suburban areas tend to use fertilizers more than people in urban areas. Okay, so that's pretty interesting from a social point of view. Also, we ask people what's most important to them in terms of the amenities or what they're gaining from these ecosystems. And overall, again, not surprising, but interesting how homogeneous it is. Here's aesthetics. I don't know if you can read this. Aesthetics, low maintenance, and biodiversity from most important to least important, which is environmental services, by the way, down here. People generally want a beautiful, neat, weed-free yard that's low maintenance across the board. That's what we're creating these landscapes for, and that generally people, regardless of where they are, tend to like these things. So I thought that was pretty cool. You know, and in fact, when we take a look at the social aspects, we also, and the ecological aspects, we see some similarities here in terms of homogeneity. This is a study by Meredith Steele, looking at the presence of water bodies in cities. So, for example, here's Miami, Florida, where there's a lot of natural water bodies, and in Phoenix, Arizona, where we don't have a lot of water in the desert. And when you have cities being created, you can see there's a convergence of the similar numbers of water bodies. So they do look relatively homogeneous. And here's some work from Peter's group looking at soil organic matter here and soil moisture. I want to emphasize here that the idea is that we're thinking that cities are more homogeneous compared to each other relative to the native ecosystem. So, for example, the forest is going to be very different from the desert. And so we're saying here, in native ecosystems, soil organic matter between Baltimore and Phoenix is really different, but in residential landscapes, it seems to be quite similar. So overall, we're seeing homogeneity in some of these soil properties. Recently, we're looking also at microclimate, getting more to people and in their homes, so what people are actually experiencing. Here's relative humidity, and here's temperature between native landscapes in each one of these cities. So this is like desert, coastal sage scrub, grassland, forest, and subtropical forest, and temperature, and the residential landscapes. And what I want you to notice is that the pink dots are getting more close to each other relative to the yellow dots are to each other. Does that make sense? So you still see a lot of difference. Obviously, Phoenix is hot and Minneapolis is not, but the dots are getting closer. And just to emphasize this, here's a standard deviation in these metrics between cities. The larger the bar means that they're very different from each other across the six cities. You can see here, here's native landscapes between temperature and relative humidity. In fact, the pink bars are closer to each other, which indicates to us that, in fact, these environments that we're creating are more homogeneous to each other than the native ecosystems are, which is it seems to support our hypotheses. I want to point out here, too, that the residential land cover seems to modify our microclimates in people's homes relatively predictably. Here's a change in temperature between the residential and native, and change in relative humidity, so it's the delta. I want to point out that, in fact, above this line, yards are warmer than their native ecosystems, and below this line, they're cooler. They're more humid above this line and drier, so that, in fact, Phoenix ecosystems are cooler and more humid than the desert. And, in fact, Miami ecosystems, even though these are in turf grass yards, they're still warmer and drier than the surrounding subtropical forests. And it's really interesting that we see this really interesting line that tends to fall out across continental scales. And what I want to point out is Minneapolis. Sitting right near that fulcrum there, this really points to this idea of the savannahization of urban landscapes, right? Because the native ecosystem here is not different so much than the residential. Well, here's the native grassland, and here's the residential grassland. And so, in fact, we're creating an ecosystem that's not so different than the native ecosystem in grassland situations. So that's been a really fun project that we've been working on to really look at the ecology of cities across these multiple scales. So that the last point that I want to make is that as ecologists, we know that ecosystems change. In fact, you know, change is the rule in natural ecosystems. And what's been happening across the country, in the East some too, as cities go from gray to green infrastructure, but especially in the West where we're dealing with droughts, is that we're seeing a massive land cover change in some of our cities going from turf grass lawns to something else. And we call these a range of things like desert landscapes or water-wise landscapes, et cetera. So what I want to make the point is that as these new sustainable landscapes come in, we as ecologists and soil scientists need to take a look and say, are there going to be some trade-offs between a different type of landscape that we think are going to hit some sustainability principles and other things that we might not be measuring? And right now, there's not a lot of data on this. So I want you to watch here. Here's data from the city of Phoenix. Low use is on the left, high water use is on the right. And from 1990 all the way through 96, you can see that there are more lawns in Phoenix. But right around 2000, there's been a pretty dramatic change between turf grass lawns and to something else. Climate-appropriate landscaping is what I hear it's called in California. And from 2000, now you can take a look at the colors here. We can see that Phoenix is essentially drying out, and we're having many fewer lawns in 2011. So now less than 20% of the homes are landscaped in turf. And a lot of people don't realize this. They come to Phoenix, they see some lawns, and they think, oh my gosh, what an unsustainable city. But in fact, people are using a lot less water now than they used to. And so what we're seeing here is here's gallons of water per day, here's a turf grass home, and here's a xeric home. It uses about half as much water, which contributes to the lower overall total water use, which has all sorts of implications, actually, for wastewater management. It's getting really salty in the water now because people are using a lot less water in their homes. So in Phoenix, we had before landscapes looking like this, and now they're looking much more like this. And so, again, going back to our social and ecological teams, we can ask, what are some of the social dynamics within these new types of landscapes that are popping up and that are already in places like Las Vegas, for example, and what are some of the ecological implications? So just going back to some of older work that we had been doing about these desert-style landscapes, and I thought you might be able to help me predict what would be some of the answers here. Here's the years that people have lived in the Phoenix area. So we know we've got a lot of migrants coming from the Midwest. As they get older, people come to retire in Phoenix, right? And so if these are newcomers and these are people who've lived there a really long time, you might imagine that people who live in the desert like the desert. What do you think about this? What type of people are most satisfied with desert landscaping? New one, okay. Well, you're actually right. We actually hypothesize that if you lived there a long time, you would appreciate the Sonoran Desert. But actually, people a while ago moved to Phoenix because it was an oasis in the desert. It was a green, golf course-y oasis in the desert, not a desert landscape. So it's the newcomers that are really appreciating these desert-style landscapes and not rejecting them so much. That's been really helpful as we get new immigrants coming into the city. Here's preference for turf grass in your backyard. This should be obvious. Number of kids, 1, 2, 3, and 4. What might you imagine, those of you who grew up with wiffle ball and frisbee? Yeah, kids need turf. Okay, so the idea that all people feel the same way about turf is really not true. And in fact, as we try to promote these desert-style landscapes, understanding who's choosing the landscape may make a difference. For example, who in your house makes decisions about most things? My husband would say that it's me because I'm super bossy. But in fact, here is the desert preference for desert-style landscape between men and women. What might you think here? Men prefer desert, the kind of prickly. Men prefer grass. In fact, here's women versus men. Women prefer grass, desert-style landscaping less. Men prefer it a little bit more. And some of the reasons why, it's the cleanliness issue. Seriously, like this is so stereotyped. It's the idea of spiny plants. I don't know, they don't want their kids or their dogs running around in the spiny plants. It's interesting. So this has been a really fun area of work to think about who's going to be liking these things. I want to mention also there's the idea that getting to this backyard has been really fun. You know, we as scientists, as environmental scientists, oftentimes humans affect the environment. But seriously, the environment changes how people do what people do. So we did a study here with a percent of residents surveyed here in 4 different neighborhoods in the Phoenix area. 2 of them are turf grass. 2 of them are landscaped in as desert style. And we asked, what are the different behaviors that people have, and how do they change their behavior with these new landscapes? And so just to emphasize here is mesic, grass in green, oasis, which means a little bit of grass, a little bit of rock, in yellow, and xeric, mostly rock, in brown. And here again, the 2 mesic and 2 xeric style neighborhoods. And what we found is that, in fact, you look at something like drip irrigation. Drip irrigation you think would go with xeric landscaping, but it really just goes with the money that it takes to put some drip irrigation into your landscape. It just really goes up with income. On the other hand, talking about some of these emergent properties or some of these surprises, here's insecticide use and herbicide use. So what happens, and I really think it's like the landscapes are telling people what to do. You now have a rock landscape, and what people want to do is keep it clean. It's like this thing, you just want to weed it. You want to weed. You want it to keep it be rock with some shrubs. You don't want to have a weedy landscape, and sometimes HOAs enforce that. So one emergent property is that, in fact, more insecticides and herbicides are used on these desert-style landscapes that conserve water. So what are some of the ecological things? We've been talking about the social things. What are some of the ecological effects of this idea of a sustainable land cover change that really does lower water use? And so it might be the way to go. Well, we know that these types of landscapes, and I'm sorry, this rock mulch got cut off, but it essentially looks like this with no grass. These rock landscapes are warmer. So one of the reasons, the kind of indirect reasons why we have lawns in Phoenix is because it's actually cooler on these lawns. It's not so nightmarish hot. But here's the temperature here, turf grass, mixed turf grass, rock and mulch, and you can see the afternoon temperatures. This isn't, like, look at the numbers here. This is really out of control, how hot it is. So it's warmer, and in fact, when you take a look at a neighborhood scale, if you are living in a xeriscape neighborhood, your whole neighborhood is warm. That might increase air conditioning. That might increase human misery. It does. I can tell you. It does increase human misery. So what are the outcomes of this? Another thing is that when you take a look at how people are changing these landscapes, it has some real implications, we think, for soil quality. And let me just walk you through this. The 7 steps for xeriscape are to essentially, and you look around cities all over, have these same 7 steps of xeriscape, which is promoted by Denver Water. You water your lawn, you fertilize it, and then you kill it. And then you either sod cut it, turn it over, and then you rototill it. And then you put some mulch to keep the water in. So what is this doing? You've got this agricultural level of nitrogen in your lawn. You're watering it, fertilizing it, killing it, giving it oxygen by tilling it, and then covering it with rock and keeping it nice, warm, and moist. It's like this perfect situation, we think, that would be for decomposition. There's a lot of nitrogen in that lawn. What happens afterwards? And so we think here in the, for example, hypothesized nitrogen dynamics in a turf grass ecosystem. If you have an interesting system here where you have a lot of plant uptake, and a lot of work from people in this room has showed that not all turf grass systems are these leaky nitrate leaking systems. Essentially, they might be very retentive if you have a lot of plant growth. We also know that it cools landscapes, and we think that there might be relatively low end losses. This is just a hypothesis. But what then happens when then you do the seven steps of xeriscape and you're going for water conservation, and then you put end fixing plants on the landscape, which is the dominant tree that people put in xeriscapes? Then you have all this dead grass that was been sod cut. In case you haven't seen it, you can't see it. It's sod cut and turned over. I turned my plants over here. And then you have all this organic N, and then you limit your plant uptake because everyone's out there weeding and herbiciding. What happens then to all the nitrogen that it might have been in this landscape? And just in the last few minutes, I just want to show just some of the new experimental results that we have coming out. This is a map of our experimental design where a graduate student is looking across a chronosequence of time since turfgrass conversion to the sustainable landscape. Here's turfgrass going into the older years here. This is going to be the metric on the y-axis. We did it across several soil depths. And what we did is we went to the lawn rebate program of the city of Tempe, got all the addresses, and then aligned our sites along this interesting chronosequence. They handed those records over to us, so they're our partners in this. So we have about N5 to 10 per category, and here are the water-wise landscapes. And what we see with organic matter, in fact, that a lot of people have seriously just buried their lawn. They put a layer of plastic down, and you see here's the organic matter in turf grass, about 6%, pretty high, and it does go down over time. So there's something about where is that organic matter going? Is it being decomposed, and is it being actually turning into carbon dioxide and nitrate potentially? Here's soil moisture. Interestingly enough, here's turf grass. These landscapes still have about 10% water in them. They're still really wet, and it's because of this idea that we put mulch down and rock cover. So these are really quite moist underneath, especially underneath the drippers. We're looking here at soil ammonium concentrations, and note the axis here, it's fairly low. We've got some end-fixing trees on the landscape. We thought we might see a larger pool of this, but of course, this is just a pool. We haven't really seen the flux here, but overall, we don't see much change. But what was so interesting to us is here's soil nitrate concentration. Turfgrass lawns are really low in soil nitrate, but they really pick up here in this intermediate, and what we might think is that after about 13 years, a lot of this organic matter is being decomposed, the nitrogen's lost, and then we go down to what we think is like a true kind of more arid landscape here. So we don't know whether leaching is actually occurring, probably not in Phoenix because there's not a lot of water flowing through. But what about California ecosystems that tend to be more sandy? So I just want to end here by saying three points is that what we can learn as soil scientists is that by trying to get one bigger, broader perspective and trying to pair with social scientists, we might be able to discover these new emergent properties that we wouldn't be able to see within discipline alone. These cross-city studies are really helpful and really fun for us because we can really study the ecology of these cities. And these emerging sustainable landscape designs should be questioned a bit, just to take a look at least some of the trade-offs. This might be the way we go, but at least we can get ahead of the curve and not be surprised. So thank you.
So we do have time for a question or two.
Yeah, the difference between a turf lawn temperature and a xeriscape temperature is 30 to 38. That's huge.
It is.
Have they come up with some way of ameliorating that effect and not using so much water?
Right. So this is a style in not all cities. So California tends to put a lot more mulch on the ground. And so what we're thinking is that potentially, instead of putting rock, one of the major recommendations is just put down mulch like other people do in other cities. So one consequence of a lot of the water that we're using in xeriscape, we use about 30% more water than these plants need. So those plants grow, we prune, there's all this biomass coming up off of these desert end-fixing trees. Why not grind it up and mulch it back onto the landscape?
So has anybody done a study to show that?
We have a handful of studies right now to do that. But it's interesting, I don't know why people have these rock lawns and what it is culturally that keeps the rock looking like the desert. In fact, it doesn't really look like the desert. I mean, it's sometimes like a xeriscape, like a
z.
It is, yeah. It is going to be, it seems like it's going to be hot, but in fact, the few studies that I've seen cool it off, because the rocks just retain all that heat. It's really hot skin temperature. Yeah.